everybody back again. Hello, Theo. How are you doing?
Okay.
At any rate, we have with us today Eric the Blacksmith. He was with us, a while ago, discussing more about the Anti-Federalist Papers with a series that is going to be piggybacked behind the one that he did a while ago, which I'll put the links up for, where he dealt with about six episodes of the Federalist Papers, Anti-Federalist Papers. But this is going to be part two of Phantasms of Freedom because, yeah, it looks like it, sounds like it, but it's not. So, Eric, thanks a lot for coming on again. Appreciate you being here.
You're welcome, Al. Hey, Theo.
Yeah, we had promised a couple things last time out, but, I mean, where you're going is where we should be going, if you know what I mean. It's been a while since we've all been together. But, yeah, you're going to pick up the track right away. And so I'm just going to throw it to you, Eric. Take it away.
Okay, Al. Thanks. I wanted to sort of go back a little further, and I'm referring again to Hologram of Liberty, which was written by Kenneth Royce. And it really is, to me, a Cliff Notes version of a lot of what The Informer and Montgomery talked about. Although he didn't get into the matter of the Pope, he didn't go back that far, but he likened the federal trickery to Houdini, of all things. And let me read an excerpt. Remember, it wasn't the people or the states which agitated for the 1787 convention. It was a distinct group of men, later called Federalists, who very much desired a strong national government. While there was widespread support for an alteration of the existing straitjacket, that is, the Articles of Confederation, to marginally free the prisoner, only the Federalists had the firm plan of changing the garment entirely with an utterly new design of their own. To them, an energetic national government was good and necessary. And while the author heartily disagrees with their conclusions, he does believe that their motives were generally sincere. He understands a father's love and devotion to his son, and therefore the founding lawyers' duty to their newborn national government. Anyway, back to the straitjacket extrication. Here's an overview of the next 150 pages, and he sort of gives a very abbreviated list. 1790, the new government's in its constitutional straitjacket. 1791, the early positioning by Hamilton's Financial Measures and Bank of the U.S. 1794, we had a violent wriggling in suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion in western Pennsylvania. 1798, we had the Alien and Sedition Acts, which was the first concerted effort by Shoulder, Arm, and Hand. Successful. Shoulder rests prior to the grand effort of 1803, which brings us to Marbury versus Madison. This is when the shoulder dislocates. The Supreme Court rules that they alone may decide what is or isn't constitutional. 1819, we have McCulloch versus Maryland. The shoulder shifts. Supreme Court rules that the Congress have implied powers other than their strictly enumerated constitutional authority. And I'll sort of throw in a little aside here that Hamilton was the one that really pushed for implied powers. And the more I look at this, the more I'm beginning to realize that Washington, his moves were really suggested by Hamilton. And it looks so much to me like Hamilton was indeed an agent of the banksters and an agent of the crown.
Eric, let me ask you something. When you talk about implied, we're looking at what we would consider the equivalent of vagaries, wide interpretation, all that kind of thing?
Sure. It goes along with what did Orwell say about the epitome of tyranny being ambiguity?
Yeah, he never used that line, but the theme keeps coming up in Orwell's writing that tyranny thrives in ambiguity.
Well, I mean, that's funny because it's like the old story about, you know, Humphrey Bogart never said play it again, Sam, but Sam played it again. You know, so, I mean, that's where we are here, but, you know, it's... But what I'm hearing here, too, and I'm not going to bloviate, it's just that given the fact that whatever's going on in Boston, somebody that's kind of close to us, Huygens, the 9/11 Truth, has been close to a situation where somebody he knows just got arrested by federal marshals for something he didn't know he did. They wouldn't tell him what he was charged with. It's all going to work out okay. But the point is, it's the scary thing, which I think you're alluding to, Eric, right there, or the works that you're citing right now allude to, and that is... anything goes. Anything goes, and you don't know what's going on, and you never will unless they, quote, they decide to tell you.
true enough, and I go back to the straitjacket. The straitjacket will reliably constrain that which it was designed to constrain, a normal physique. Change the body and escape is now not only possible, but simply a matter of time and effort. Basically, the Constitution was the dislocation of the shoulder that permitted not only the founding lawyers, but subsequent generations of politicians and tricksters to pull what they've pulled.
All right, let me ask you again, and also, Theo, if you got any questions to back it, just jump in, because, I mean, things are hitting me, and I'm sure they are you, and I don't mean to be rude to you. But what I'm hearing is that when we were going through school and the public school system was like, well, it's a living document and it's elastic and it can be made. Yeah, it can be made to do whatever the hell you want to make it do. And usually that's not good for us. So this bit about, as you're just saying now, it was a straitjacket that kind of got busted out over here a little bit and busted out over there a little bit. Before you know it, you got some kind of amorphous thing that doesn't look like anything that was first devised.
That's correct. Now, in 1824, we have Gibbons versus Ogden. The shoulder's doing some more maneuvering. The Supreme Court strikes down New York law by stretching commerce to mean intercourse, not merely movement of goods, basis for later federal regulation of nearly everything. 1876, we have Munn versus Illinois. Now, this is when the Supreme Court rules that, quote, when private property is devoted to public use, it is subject to public regulation, unquote. Now, up to the 30s, we have the arms sliding out of the sleeves because we have Congress taking full advantage of shoulder dislocation by the expanded necessary and proper, that's in quotes, legislation. And the 1930s, arm free of sleeve, that was the New Deal legislation goes through on back of Supreme Court reversals of Tenth Amendment doctrine. And it continues to this day. The arms out, hand working on buckle. As the congressional arm is totally free, the executive hand can finally be put to work. It's up to the 1980s, and, you know, we've got the Exclusionary Rule Reform Act. That was H.R. 666, interestingly enough, passed by all of but seven of new Republicans. And now we've got the audience in near panic running for the exits. And it was interesting how he did use this analogy, where he says the executive is the hand, Congress is the arm, and the Supreme Court is the shoulder. Yes, the branches of government are distinct, but they are part of the same federal torso with a naturally unified goal to be free. The checks and balance doctrine now seems properly hollow. It makes no sense that the shoulder and arm will jointly prevent the hand's grope. So the bottom line is, yeah, we're screwed.
Well, you see, at this point in my life, when I'm looking back at all the stuff I've done for 12 years, I come back to a point about I'd like to give the benefit of the doubt, blah, blah, blah. And I will do that. And even in this situation, I would say, look, the Articles of Confederation and the way that the new states wanted to conduct themselves probably wouldn't have worked down the road. That's okay. But you don't lie to the people and tell them you're going to tweak the articles and then give them something new and throw over everything else. That's my point. And what you're just speaking about here is that, okay, I can understand it. What are you telling me? If you got something private and you use it to service the public, it now becomes under what? Federal jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
All right. I mean, I can even understand that to a certain extent. Regulation, I mean, does everybody run wild? But then it goes to a point where it gets out of hand, and then the pendulum swings so far the other way, and that's where the problem comes. And that's why people are always distrusting when you start something, because it seems like, and rightfully so, you would say, well, it's a slippery slope. You bet your butt it's a slippery slope. And
well, it's interesting.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
That's okay. I was gonna ask Theo what he thought.
Well, the founding lawyers, if they had to meet in secret, that
right.
should be a huge warning sign. Whenever somebody's got to meet in secret, there's something they're doing that's not right.
But
yeah.
Theo, you're right too. I mean, even as we see today, though, every time the government doesn't want your nose into something which you probably have a right to investigate, they tell you it's, oh, no, now it's national security. That's why terrorism is the greatest thing that's ever come to any government is because it's none of your business right down the line. No matter what, none of your business. Can't do it. Can't reveal it. Nope, sorry, terrorism, national security. And that's where we are today.
Especially in light of recent events in Boston, Sandy Hook, and I wanted to go to what a prominent anti-federalist sentinel had to say about some of these matters. In fact, some of the emails that we've been swapping back and forth lately. This was excerpted from his letter 15, penned 22nd of February, 1788. And the more I look at these letters, and the more I see the behavior of the founding fraudsters, which is what, I'm now calling them, which is really what the founding fraudsters.
Wait a minute, hold on, Barrick, but you can't miss one thing that's so beautiful. It was on Washington's birthday he wrote this.
Yes, you're right.
Up yours, George.
Up yours, George. It's oh, wait till you hear the one I have to say about Rhode Island. And Rhode Island is a scrappy little state that we will be discussing. Okay, quote, and listen to this in light of what's happening today and what's basically been happening in light of the show that you two did about false flags. Quote, the science of government being the most abstruse and unobvious of all others, mankind are more liable to be imposed upon by the artful and designing in systems and regulations of government than on any other subject. Hence, a jealousy of innovation confirmed by uniform experience prevails in most communities. This reluctance to change has been found to be the greatest security of free governments and the principal bulwark of liberty. For the aspiring and ever-restless spirit of ambition would otherwise, by her deceptive wiles and ensnaring glosses, triumph over the freest and most enlightened people. It is the most peculiar misfortune of the people of these United States at this awful crisis of public affairs to have lost this useful, this absolutely necessary jealousy of innovation in government, and thereby to lie at the mercy and be exposed to the artifices of ambition without this usual shield to protect them from imposition. The conspirators, well aware of their advantage, have seized the favorable moment and by the most unparalleled arts of deception have obtained the sanctions of the conventions of several states to the most tyrannic system of government ever projected. Unquote.
That's a heavy-duty phrase right there. The most tyrannic system of government ever projected. Now, that would be a hard sell for any of us to try to break down for a audience of any kind of people. And I would say that probably, let's put it this way. We've had it pretty good, but now the cannons are pointed at us. Now the bears turned around and chasing us. And now we're going to see, just as that last sentence said, how tyrannic our form of government can be. And people are not ready for it, but they are accepting it in gradations, which is amazing to me.
Well, I'm reminded of two things, of George Orwell's quote about nationalism, how it's okay if we do it, but they can't. And also what you talked about with Man for All Seasons.
Oh, geez, yes. Yep. Classic. And that's what's happening right now, which is one of the reasons I brought it back out. And I'll post that a brief excerpt, which is the shorter version, but it's got the really good stuff. And that is, if you break everything down to chase the bad guys, take every law and lay it low, what happens when it comes the other way? But you see, people don't think their government will do that. And, you know, and Theo, you've seen it. And Eric, you've seen it. You've seen the photos of people being chased out of their houses to protect them. And these poor people are like barefoot. It's like, wait a second, man. I mean, will you stop with this kind of stuff? Search the damn house, but don't chase these people out. Where are they going to go? To some other house that they're going to get chased out of? And everybody's applauding this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, it makes me think back to that excerpt. Well, I'll play that as well. The audio from the Gladiator, where Gracchus says in that last time that the senators all get together, you know, talking about the masses. Give them death and they will love you for it. Well, damn, that was what's going on in Boston is pretty close to that kind of thing. So, I mean, we strayed afar, but aren't we talking about exactly what the Sentinel said back then? Now it's turning to tyrannic. It wasn't that way necessarily all the time. There are a lot of winners in this society and such. There are a lot of losers, I understand. But, you know, let's give us the benefit of the doubt for having a decent lifestyle. But that is over with, and people don't know the deal is done. And, Theo, I'm going to throw it to you if you want to jump in on there. And, of course, Eric, you pick it up on the other side.
Okay.
Having just read for the first time the famous treatise Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville, I don't think he got it all right. It's a classic as far as anecdotal evidence of what America was like in the early 1800s. When he starts waxing philosophical about government, not so much. But when he writes about why America was our antecedents then, why they had so many rights, why they had so much, you know, quote unquote freedom, I think he properly identifies it as it had a heck of a lot more to do with just the luck of geography than it had to do with anything the founding lawyers or any noble ideals that this country ever had. We just got lucky. We had weak neighbors to the north, weak neighbors to the south, and the native Aborigines were weak, and we had huge oceans separating us from any potential enemies, and that's why we were left alone for so long. But the world, you know, who doesn't say nowadays it's a global economy nowadays? Well, the fact that it is a global economy, it's a global everything, means that now our former freedoms, well, they already have been. They've been shut down. And the only reason most people don't realize that anymore is because one thing we do have nowadays that previous generations hadn't had was we have more toys to play with. As George Carlin said, we have cell phones that can make flapjacks, but we own nothing.
It is true. I think there was something else he said the phone did, but
never mind.
I won't mention it here. I have a coworker who talked about wanting to become a sovereign citizen.
Yes.
And I think I had mentioned this in some emails that we swapped back and forth.
Yes, you did.
And a young guy, decent guy, as a shop steward, I get questions from my fellow workers ranging from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Godfather.
What's that? Oh.
A Brando impersonation.
Well, yeah.
Ah, yes. And
thanks, Theo.
I'll tell you what, if we'd done the show a couple of weeks ago, I would have really been able to do his voice because I had bronchitis so bad.
No, all you need is Kleenex and stuff in your jowls. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
So he wants to become a sovereign citizen. And he was spouting the usual, we the people, / Constitution, and we have this and we have that. And I told him, I said, first of all, put a sock in it. You're going to have to stick the cotton in your mouth and pull it out of your ears for what I'm going to tell you. First of all, I'm going to ask you if you want to take the red pill. He said, yes. I said, I have an interesting series of interviews that you're going to want to listen to. So I've been sending him these interviews. Now, he had some paperwork that he was going to submit to the state. And I told him in so many words, I said, what you're going to learn is nothing you ever learned in school, nothing you've ever heard from your parents, nothing you've heard from any of your friends, certainly nothing you've read in your local newspaper, and certainly nothing you've ever seen on CBS News. So I saw him again. The paperwork was stuffed in his drawer. He had that 3,000-yard look in his eyes, and he was practically slack-jawed, and he was telling me about how much he didn't know, how much he had to learn, and he's going to have to rethink this whole thing. So basically, his run had slowed to a crawl. I talked with him today, and he was saying that it was far more involved than he'd ever dreamed, especially when I told him the informer did not talk to anybody in this country. He had to talk to the Holy See of Antioch. Now, when I said that to him originally, he thought I had bananas coming out of my ears because that's how he looked at me.
Was it Antioch or Rome, Eric?
I believe it was the Holy See. If you listen to the informer, when he got out of the IRS system, he filed an administrative complaint to the Holy See.
Well, the point's well taken, but that's another whole thing we're going to spend about 5 years trying to break down for folks.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to think we all have bananas growing out of our ears. But go ahead, Eric, go ahead.
But anyway, I don't want to get too far afield. Anyway, I wanted to mention to him what we were taught wasn't true. So the bottom line is he's learned stuff, and it was really refreshing. I guess where I'm going with all this, it was really refreshing to have somebody actually be interested in learning about some of this stuff.
Kudos to him. Most people don't have the ears to hear what sounds like he was humble enough to listen to you.
Yeah, and I wanted to also talk about something that happened to me years ago. My wife's family lives in London, and there's the public records office over in Kew, which is a town over from Richmond, which is on the outskirts of London. And they've got all kinds of different historical artifacts and documents, including the Magna Carta. Now, this was before I was wise to any of this stuff. So I walk in, you know, the proud American who's going to show these pasty Brits, you know, where the bear sits in the buckwheat. So I ask them if I can see the Magna Carta. And I alluded to some kind of freedom, and I could have sworn I saw one of them stifle a chuckle. And there was a woman there, if I remember right. This was back around 2000, 1999. And I could have sworn I heard one of them say to the other, "You think we should tell him?" And I could have sworn I heard the other one say, "Shh, shh, no." And I wonder what they were referring to.
Yeah. This guy doesn't know he's a citizen of the crown, too, a subject of the crown.
Exactly right.
Oh,
we should include a brief description of what the I-Man and Montgomery laid out regarding that, as to why the Magna Carta was actually a worthless document.
Well, I'll tell you, if you're going to do it, you're going to have to hit the high points, only because, yes, all the stuff we talk about demands more time, without a doubt. So I'm not dissuading you from doing it, but hit it.
Okay, well, real quick, two points. The minor point is it was a document signed under duress, and in law, that's a document that doesn't count. Number two, King John of England at the time, in 1213, had already given up possession of England to Rome, to the Pope at the time. 2 years later, he supposedly gave these rights to the barons, the noblemen of England. He didn't have the right to do so. He wasn't in charge of England anymore, technically. It was the Pope. So when the Pope, shortly after the Magna Carta was signed, the Pope renounced it, the Pope had the right to do so.
Well, and there's a method to my madness, because the good little state of Rhode Island was threatened by Washington for not towing the constitutional line. Now, they didn't want to sign up for the Constitution, the state of Rhode Island, in 1790. It was the only state that had a chance to vote on the Constitution, and the people of Rhode Island rejected it 11-1. Now, my question is, if the state of Rhode Island was forced into a contract, wouldn't that make it null and void? Probably not, because the Pope and the King didn't want it to be null and void.
Yeah.
All right, well, here's Anti-Federalist Paper number 15. Rhode Island is right. This essay appeared in the Massachusetts Gazette December 7th, 1787, as reprinted from the Freeman's Journal. The abuse which has been thrown upon the state of Rhode Island seems to be greatly unmerited. Popular favor is variable, and those who are now despised and insulted may soon change situations with the present idols of the people. Rhode Island has outdone even Pennsylvania in the glorious work of freeing the Negroes in this country, without which the patriotism of some states appears ridiculous. The General Assembly of the state of Rhode Island has prevented the further importation of Negroes, and have made a law by which all blacks born in that state after March 1784 are absolutely and at once free. They have fully complied with the recommendations of Congress in regard to the late treaty of peace with Great Britain, and have passed an act declaring it to be the law of the land. They have never refused their quota of taxes demanded by Congress, accepting the 5% imposed, which they considered as a dangerous tax, and for which at present there is perhaps no great necessity, as the Western territory, of which a part has very lately been sold at a considerable price, may soon produce an immense revenue, and, in the interim, Congress may raise, in the old manner, the taxes which shall be found necessary for the support of the government. The state of Rhode Island refused to send delegates to the federal convention, and the event has manifested that their refusal was a happy one, as the new constitution, which the convention has proposed to us, is an elective monarchy, which is proverbially the worst government. This new government would have been supported at a vast expense, by which our taxes, the right of which is solely vested in Congress, wait for it, a circumstance which manifests that the various states of the Union will be merely corporations, would be doubled or trebled. The liberty of the press is not stipulated for, and therefore may be invaded at pleasure. The Supreme Continental Court is to have, almost in every case, quote, appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, unquote, which signifies, if there is any meaning in words, the setting aside the trial by jury. Congress will have the power of guaranteeing to every state a right to import Negroes for 21 years, by which some of the states who have now declined this iniquitous traffic may re-enter into it, for the private laws of every state are to submit to the superior jurisdiction of Congress. A standing army is to be kept on foot, by which the vicious, the sycophantic, and the time-serving will be exalted, and the brave, the patriotic, and the virtuous will be depressed. The writer, therefore, thinks it the part of wisdom to abide, like the state of Rhode Island, by the old Articles of Confederation, which, if re-examined with attention, we shall find worthy of great regard, that we should give high praise to the manly and public-spirited 16 members who lately seceded from our House of Assembly in Pennsylvania, and that we should all impress with great care this truth on our minds, that it is very easy to change a free government into an arbitrary one, but that it is very difficult to convert tyranny into freedom.
All right, now, so we're talking about Rhode Island, right?
Yes.
And say, they said jam the Constitution, correct?
Yes, they did.
And then what happened?
Well, they ended up caving. They had another meeting where the Constitution was approved by a vote of 34 to 32.
But why did they cave? Under threat of what?
Under threat of embargo.
Right.
Washington. It was Rhode Island was the last of the original 13 states to ratify the U.S. Constitution, May 29, 1790, doing so after being threatened by having its exports taxed as a foreign nation. Rural resistance to the Constitution was strong in Rhode Island, and the Anti-Federalist Country Party controlled the General Assembly from 1786 to 1790.
Why have I never heard this before?
For the same reason nobody else has.
What's that?
No, I'm sorry, Eric. Go ahead. I mean, we're not supposed to be told this stuff. That's why it isn't there.
That's a fact.
We were all supposed to have loved the Constitution. This is a great and wonderful thing. Don't question it. All the founding fathers were demigods. It's okay. And that's why we're doing all this whole thing. And here's another thing, you know, Theo, that we've never even heard of. When Eric told me this, I'm like, huh?
Yeah. Well, that's like the whole business of the Russian delegation coming over with ships and celebrations and being in San Francisco and New York, and basically they were given the red carpet treatment. I never heard about that in school.
Well, of course. Now, here's another thing also, and Theo, you'll understand where this is coming from if you refer back to Albion Seed, okay?
Yeah.
Can you imagine how disparate in beliefs and demeanor and everything else the Cavaliers were of the Middle Atlantic, the Southern states, from those in New England? New England has always been, screw you, I don't care, eat shit or die. Oh, I'm sorry, that's live free or die. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, New England was like, you know, jam it, I don't care. And they were always recalcitrant with regard to the way that the rest of, you would say, the 13, you know, seaboard colonies turned to states were. I mean, think about it. I mean, what in the world did those craggy people up in New England have to do with the Cavaliers and their plantations starting in Maryland and going straight on down to Georgia?
Cato discusses that in some of his letters. He talks about the vast expanse of the United States and how someone in Maine or New Hampshire will hardly be able to identify with, say, a farmer in Georgia.
Well, Eric, you're not familiar with Albion Seed, are you?
I've heard of it, but I'm not really familiar with it, no.
It's okay, but you know where I'm going with this, right, Theo?
Oh, yeah. There were four, what's the author's name? He calls them folkways from England that settled America.
Yeah, folkways meaning there were four migrations that came out of the U.K. And, you know, you had certain people. I mean, the Scots went, the Scot-Irish went to, like, the Highlands, the Appalachians. Go ahead.
They went into the Appalachians and to the west. They kept getting shunted west as a buffer to fight the Indians because none of the other three groups wanted them.
No, because the Cavaliers were royalty, and they didn't want to get their, you know, their little satin dresses dirty. So, I mean, but it's true. And that's why, you know, that's one of the reasons why it's funny. But West Virginia wanted nothing to do with the South in the Civil War. It's like, hey, this is about plantations, man. Have you seen any plantations on the side of a mountain in West Virginia?
We can quickly identify the other ones. Like, you got the Scotch-Irish. And then you have the Cavaliers in Virginia. You've got the Puritans in the North.
Right.
And then you had the Quakers in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's another whole deal. I tell you what.
Albion Seed, huh?
Yeah, Albion Seed. It really does read like a doctoral dissertation. And Theo, did I give you that book?
Yeah, you did. I read the whole thing. It was.
Yeah. Renaissance Landscaper gave me that, and it blew me away. But, of course, that was like in the 1980s when I'm not thinking the way I am today. But when I hearken back to that, I'm like, now things make perfect sense. In the sense that, Eric, what they're saying is that still to this day, which is not a big surprise, especially in the East, the way that this country was settled by whatever sections of the U.K., be it Ireland, Scotland, Wales, you know, Britain, whatever, the dialects are witness to this. There is a difference,
yeah.
And that difference was carried over here and also exacerbated some of the divisions between what you might call the dirty hoi polloi's and the royalty, the Cavaliers, who were plantation people on the tidelands of Virginia and up in Maryland and in the Carolinas.
It is such a meticulous book, and it's totally interesting, absorbing, but like you just referenced, he gets into the dialects, and apparently the dialects also trace back to England. One that I recall, and that refers to those Cavaliers, is, you know, we're most familiar with the Southern drawl and all that. Well, there's another one. There's this specific Virginia dialect that in Albion Seed they go into, and I've always wondered because it wasn't quite a Southern drawl. There was something else going on. And this guy totally explains it, and it's a Cavalier thing going back to England. When people from the Virginia area, these Cavalier and posterity, when they say the word the long O sound, like in the word goat, they will say it like gout, as though it was G-A-O-T. And you will hear it when they say any kind of long O sound. It's interesting. And I didn't know it goes back to,
sure
to
it does.
The
yeah.
English Cavaliers.
In fact, the closest English dialect there is in the United States is in New England and Boston in particular. And then
especially Boston.
Yeah, and it changes. I mean, but what we look at is like, you know, habit, cavit, you know, a lot of the stuff. It's a reflection of that. But the whole of it is this, and what we've been trying to say is that in many, many ways, also politically and economically, but also societally and culturally, we've never really divorced ourselves from, you know, Mother England.
No, we haven't. It seems that these characteristics are manifesting themselves even today. Albion Seed. They're just. It sounds to me like it's carried right through to today.
Eric, I know. Let me take a look. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. So you can pace yourself as far as how much time we have left to go. And, of course, we'll be back again. I'd like to throw something in that brings us back to the Constitution and to try to clarify in people's minds why the Constitution isn't for us. Can you allow me to do about three quick paragraphs, and then I'll throw it back to you? Would that be all right?
Sure.
Can you work with that? All right. I think you'll understand why. I got a PDF from Joey Phillips. I think you'll remember Joey Phillips, Theo.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where he excerpted this work, so I can't really give tight attribution, but I'm going to credit at least Joey for doing this. But here's a statement about the founding fathers and the framers and all that, whatever you want to call them, that signed the Constitution. So let me just run this by you, and any feedback, fine, and then Eric, take it away. All right, here we go. To make it really clear here, all right, the founders, okay, these are 56 signers of the compact, which is known as the Constitution, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Had hired mercenaries from the borrowed money via France to fight King George due to the Stamp Act and various legislative parliament acts. Yes. All right, that's a little bit out there, okay, but let me continue, all right? So I'm not going to get – anyway, that sets it up. Citizens are not sovereign. They are subjects. And subjects are slaves. The 56 signers were truly sovereign. The 56 signers maintain the power to tax the subject/citizens, of the state's jurisdictions through concurrent jurisdiction set up through the various royal charters by the king, that is Virginia Charter, Massachusetts Bay Colony, or Company, East India Trading Company, for the repayment of the debt via land grants. And something that is granted may be ungranted. This is why rent is paid. Because tenants don't own land. Last paragraph, and I'm out of here. The conscripted mercenary army surrounded the founders in Philadelphia and demanded they be paid. The founders had to flee to Annapolis and sued the king for peace. Paris Peace Treaty, 1783. The king agreed and recognized those 56. Now, here's where it gets really important. He recognized those 56 signers as sovereigns. Sovereigns without subjects. The rest of the subjects, you and me, still belong to the king. Citizens are not sovereigns, and tenants rent land. In other words, the 56 signers save their asses and let us all fry in the pan.
Indeed, they were in CYA mode.
All right, so thank you for letting me do that. But, I mean, that's to clear up people that they got that together to save their own butts of those who would come along in their own lines.
Yes. All right. I wanted to mention a correction. I talked about a book in the last installment, and I said Song of Liberty. I'm sorry, Song of Thunder. It was Son of Thunder. That was the book about Patrick Henry.
Do you have an author on that? I got to go back and see if I had put that up.
Not right in front of me.
All right, no problem. I'll take a look. Son of Thunder, okay. It is, okay?
Yes, and there were 85 Anti-Federalist Papers. I was initially confused because I got the impression that there were other little missives, small paragraphs, notes. But I suppose the 85 main letters are the ones that are prominently featured. And I have a list, the Anti-Federalist authors.
Okay.
All right, pseudonym, many pseudonyms, and the real name, we're known. Okay, Mercy Warren was known as a Colombian patriot. DeWitt Clinton was known as a countryman. And we had a customer. We had a Democratic Federalist. We had a farmer and planter, a Federalist, a Federal Republican, a Georgian, a Newport man, a Republican Federalist who is believed to be James Warren, Agrippa, who the informer mentions quite a number of times, was James Winthrop. Alfred, an American, an observer, an officer of the late Continental Army, who was known as William Finley, an old Whig, Amicus, Aristocratus, I think I'm getting that right, and Robert Yates was known as Brutus. Then there was Brutus Jr., Candidus, who was Benjamin Austin, and my favorite, Cato, who was George Clinton. And we had Helvidius Priscus, who was James Warren. We had John Humble. We had Leonidas. We had Massachusettensis, Montezuma, Philadelphiensis, Philanthropos, Melancton Smith was known as Plebeian. We had Republicus, Robert Yates was Sidney, and we had the federal farmer, who the informer also talks about, that was Richard Henry Lee. We had the plain dealer, who was known as Spencer Roan. We had the yeomanry of Massachusetts, Vox Populi, William Penn, Consider Arms, Samuel Field, William Grayson, Patrick Henry, John Lansing, Sentinel, who was known, or his real name was Samuel or George Bryan, Cincinnatus, Deliberator, Hampton, Gilbert Livingston, Luther Martin, who I talked about last time, George Mason, Malachi Maynard, Eliezer Oswald, John F. Mercer, and Joseph Taylor. So it was a much wider, much more diverse group of individuals writing the Anti-Federalists, whereas we had with the Federalist Papers, the Three Stooges, and I really don't mean to insult Mulberry and Curley, we had Jay, Hamilton, and Madison. And it was revealed that Madison, or Hamilton, was actually trying to take credit. And I have an excerpt here where it talks about this mask of anonymity put on by the authors for sound political reasons made it possible for Hamilton, in a note written just before his death and discovered just after, to lay claim to a full 63 numbers of the Federalist, some of which very plainly belonged to Madison. Just why this man of honor and sound memory, more like convenient memory, should have engaged in this extraordinary action is impossible to explain. In any case, he touched off a tortuous dispute that went on for generations over the authorship of the various papers, especially numbers 49 through 58, 62, and 63. By 1944, these were proven by Professor Douglas Adair to be Madison's. Basically, Hamilton was a con man's con man.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All the money guys are.
Yeah.
Just like you've said before, the states wanted to act as countries unto themselves. And that's what they thought they were getting. Now, whether that would be doable down the road is arguable, and probably it might not have. There might have been something that had to be more or less encompassing, but they did not want what they got with the Constitution. And as you know, Theo, too, it got tightened even more with the 14th Amendment after the Civil War.
I'm getting that old same surreal feeling again. You had this broad spectrum who were writing, broad spectrum of the populace writing the Anti-Federalist Papers, and for the Federalist Papers you had only
the elites,
the three aristocratic scumbags, and yet today we're only taught about the Federalist Papers, the three aristocratic scumbags.
Well, that's so American, though.
Yeah.
It is American. Yeah, you know, did you realize that there was a civil war was narrowly averted in 1788?
Mm-hmm.
And you had an Anti-Federalist politician and a revolutionary general named William West. He led an armed force of 1,000 men to Providence to oppose a 4th of July celebration of the ninth state ratifying the Constitution.
Oh, I did not know that.
So what was Willis?
Well, there's a guy named James Ostrowski, and I'm not sure what his bibliography is.
He's Polish.
He writes, "The Union established by the Articles of Confederation, in spite of its exhortation of perpetuity, was terminated by nothing other than a secession. The proposed Constitution provided that it would take effect upon ratification by 9 states. On the 21st of June, 1788, New Hampshire became the 9th state to ratify. On that date, a new union was formed, exclusive of Virginia, New York, North Carolina, and Rhode Island, which had not yet ratified. That new union seceded from the union formed by the Articles of Confederation in violation of Article 13, which barred any alteration in the Articles save by unanimous consent. It gets better. So for those who believe in the social contract, the ratification of the Constitution was illegal because it, one, violated Article 13, and two, the new illegal union of 9 states threatened Rhode Island to sign the new contract, and legally and morally speaking, any contract that is signed because of a threat makes the contract null and void.
Like the Magna Carta.
That's right.
But the Magna Carta was vitiated anyway, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, by the Pope.
By the Pope,
he had the
right. So. But what I want to know here is, all right, you know, this is vague to me, and so you brought it back to me, so I'm going to ask you, there was an idea for what, the New England states to kind of, like, separate?
Well, I'm sorry, what was that, Al?
That there was a movement by whatever constituted the New England states at that time to separate or not to be included in the Constitution. Can you clear me up on that?
Not to be included.
Okay.
This new union they were talking about, these states, I mean, I'm not really up on the specifics of it, but it looks to me like these states still had internal, you know, squabbles, especially North Carolina and Rhode Island. Virginia and New York, they hadn't signed on yet. But there was somebody in one of these forums who was saying, well, maybe it was legal because it was an economic threat, as opposed to a military threat. But wouldn't an embargo be a military threat? I say yes.
It would be both, yeah.
Yeah.
But you see, here's the other thing also now, and this might be looked as a, I don't know, kind of a nitpicking point, but Lysander Spooner was saying, you're not one of those 56, so this contract's not binding on you. And then, but others would say, well, look, you have representatives to do this, blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. But at the time that that constitution was struck, there were no representatives from the states there. There were just representatives that were sent there that really were not elected. They just went there and got this done. And
said, in secrecy.
Yeah, in secrecy. But it's like, and it's done. It's like, well, who the hell sent you there? I had no idea you were going to do that. So right from the very beginning in this brand new country with democracy, blah, 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 they already had any kind of participation wrested from them when you send these characters down. I mean, you know what the equivalent would be today? To send, like, the Philadelphia, like, Ted Turner, Warren Buffett. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what are these guys doing there? And they're speaking for me? Why? Oh, well, you know, your state sent them there. Yeah, but I didn't. I mean, who? You know, this is even Electoral College.
You remember that famous line, that famous story? We're told after that so-called constitutional convention where Benjamin Franklin was accosted by some average Joe.
And, the rabble, yes.
Yeah, say, what kind of a government did you give us? Yeah. And he said, you know, famously, a republic if you can keep it. Now, specifically with Ben Franklin, who the hell elected him?
Nobody.
Nobody.
He was never elected to anything, and this guy, I mean, you know, it's the old story. Here's what's interesting also. People get all bent out of shape about voting for a president and stuff, but what's interesting is it's like the old Chinese menu. With one, you get, like egg roll. I mean,
egg roll, yep.
Yeah, I mean, you elect a president, and you get, like, 17 other people who are unelected. And I just want to let you in on something, Eric, that I had written to Theo, and I think you saw it because I was like, kind of, like, playing a game with, you know, somewhat lamenting over the passing of Nikita Khrushchev all those years ago.
Uh-huh.
And Khrushchev and Theo thought I was kidding around. I mean, Khrushchev in a memoir said, you know, when Ike was president, I knew John Foster Dulles was.
That is a hugely telling quote.
Of course
it was. Yes, it is. I recall that.
Do you recall it at the time, because you and I are closer in age, or do you remember that the email went through?
Remember that the email went through.
Okay. But I mean, I'm trying to think where I got it. But like I said to Theo, it's another one of those aha moments I had growing up where you stop and you go, what was that about? But you're like 11. So what am I supposed to do? Worry about this? You know, I want to play baseball and chase girls. Go away. But the thing was, I always remembered it because it's that kind of thing that sticks in you. And I mean, Khrushchev knew the game too, and he knew the handshake. Let's get that straight. But Khrushchev was funny because I mean, he just like busted everybody's chops. But but when he said that, I remembered it. And as I look back at the weakness of Ike, so to speak, as a chief executive, and at the absolute demonic power of the Dulles brothers, would that be any stretch to think that exactly was the case? And get this, the Dulles brothers' uncle was Robert Lansing, who kicked William Jennings Bryan in the ass and got him out as Secretary of State. So he and Tumulty and the boys and House could go ahead and make sure that there would be war, even though Woodrow Wilson ran on the ticket about, I'll keep our boys out. Yeah, well, that didn't work out, did it?
And also, it was either Allen's or John Foster Dulles' son. I think it was John Foster. His son went on to be a, you guessed it, high-ranking Jesuit priest.
Oh, gee.
Say
it ain't
so.
How convenient.
Live in Georgetown? Anyway. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Here we go.
No, I was just going to say that I'm going to surmise at this point that the reason those states had not yet signed on to the Constitution was that there were so many internal squabbles.
Absolutely.
Say with Virginia and New York. I mean, we know that North Carolina and Rhode Island basically they were voting nay quite loudly. In fact, North Carolina, they were next in line for an embargo or a threat.
But here's our wonderful government that we're told about, and as soon as the country is struck as far as being a country, where the colonies are now called e-states, the same stuff happens. It's like, why don't you just call out the Crown's dragoons and let's get it over with? By the way, the dragoons were still here until everything settled down, weren't they?
Yes, and they were sent, you know, these framers, fraudsters, founders, lawyers were sent to revise, not to abolish. Although 55 delegates attended the convention, 14 would later quit. And that was referred to in the letter 15 that I read, generally because of the convention's gross disregard for its state's mandate and go home. Conveniently ignored by most of the remaining 41 delegates was the stubborn fact, virtually admitted by Madison in Federalist Number 40, that convention delegates had not been charged by their respective states to scrap the Articles of Confederation. And William Patterson to the convention 9th and 15th of June 1787 said, we ought to keep within its limits, the Confederation Congress mandates, that is, or we shall be charged by our constituents with usurpation.
Yeah, well, that didn't happen.
No, the idea of a national government replacing the present Confederation of States never entered into the mind of any of them, and to the public mind we must accommodate ourselves. We have had no power to go beyond the Confederation, and if we had, the people are not ripe for any other form of government. We must follow the people will not follow us. So, obviously, that didn't happen.
That whole quote was from Patterson?
Yes.
A Jersey boy.
That's right.
Yeah.
quick side note, Eric, and I didn't know this, but as you mentioned, the two states that were the most opposing to ratifying the Constitution were Rhode Island and North Carolina. I totally didn't know. But has it dawned on you that, interestingly enough, I mean, and we mentioned Albion's Seed, that book, and how it shows that the effects of a culture, it's durable, it's lasting. And nowadays, the two people who have raised the most questions, these questions we're talking about, the I-Man and James Montgomery, where do they both stem from? North Carolina.
No, that's where they live, but I-Man is from Jersey.
That's, yes.
I didn't know that.
Right. That's okay. Look at us. I'm from Jersey, too. You think I'm going along with this crap?
Hey, Al, I have a question. Did I send you the book? I know I sent you the book about the molasses disaster, but did I also send you one, the Encyclopedia of American History?
No, I remember that, no.
Okay.
No, the last, this is going to be funny, nobody will understand it. Yeah, the molasses book was a blast, excuse me. When was the streets of Boston ran brown with molasses that day, or what?
Yep, January 1919, a molasses tank blew.
Oh,
and something like 15 to 20 people were killed.
I mean, that,
and my dad was born and raised in Boston. And he said that even in the 30s, when he was growing up, on certain days you could actually smell molasses in the air.
Yeah. All right, we're coming up hard against it, but I would like to, and you're going to come back, right, because you have to. Eric.
Sure thing, I'll be back. I'm like a bad nickel.
Yeah, and you're welcome here all the time. But the reason why we're getting into this is to try to, well, I'm not gonna put it in my words. Why don't you just tell us why you've taken the time to try to bring this out into some kind of life for whatever people it will shine upon?
I've long believed that to get an idea of where we're going, we really have to have a good idea of where we come from, because human nature stays remarkably static. We may smell better today, but truly, really, have our characters really changed? Have the temptations of the flesh been any less today than they were 1,000 years ago? I say nay.
Nope.
And I do believe that if I can do some small part into saying things that will make people, or at least convince them, or try to, I don't know, plant the seed to become what George Carlin said that the establishment hates, people who can practice critical thinking, I'll give it a lame attempt. So to answer your question, Al, I'm going to say to know where we need to go, we have to know where we come from. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
No, I mean, we're now coming to the hard side of what we struck back then. That's why that quote that you read from the Sentinel is so poignant, and that is we are now seeing tyranny, and folks are taking it little by little. And I'm sorry to say, with all due respect to those that were injured and killed and the families that surround those folks up in Boston, but what you applauded is the shape of things to come. You might want to think about that. Theo, you want to throw something in there before we...
Well, we referred to Orwell earlier, and his a constant theme that kept coming up in many of his writings, tyranny thrives in ambiguity. Just to flesh it out a little more, two specific things that happened to him or that he put into his writing. In his book, Homage to Catalonia, his real-life volunteer service fighting in the Spanish Civil War, he noted that once that civil war descended into tyranny, that there were no laws, no specific written laws against anything, but there were, nevertheless, it was understood that there were certain things that you did that could get you thrown in jail kind of permanently. And later on in his, of course, most famous book, 1984, he had the government of Oceania, Big Brother, nothing was against the law. He specifically says that. There were no laws against anything. However, it was generally understood that certain things could get you killed. That's what we're talking about.
And with that, we're going to have to go.